So my family and I are in Rocky Mountain National Forest late last summer. Loving it. And one night, Seamus and Savannah and I went to a little lecture by these guys that are studying the moon. I think, Jedediah, you were probably eating somewhere, right? Yeah. Anyway, we go to this lecture on the moon. You may not know that there is an ongoing moon program. There are satellites going around the moon, mapping the moon. There is a thing on the moon that's studying its composition of its soil and all that stuff. So, like, you thought it all ended with the Apollo program. Au contraire. The moon program is alive and well, and they'd love to do all sorts of things. But in a lecture like that, they share with you all kinds of facts and figures and interesting ideas and things that you like to file away. And it, in reflecting upon what we heard, I realized that there are two kinds of statements in this world. There are statements that are you just sort of file away that are interesting. And then there are statements with implications. So let me give you an example from the lecture. In the lecture, we heard that the moon's orbital radius is 384,000 kilometers, give or take one or two, right? That's how far it goes. That's how far it is from the Earth at any given time. And that's an interesting statement. That's what accounts for why we have tides, and that accounts for how it has a gravitational effect on our tectonic plates and all those things. That's its orbital radius, and you sort of know that and remember that. That's a statement of fact. But then there was another statement that they made, namely that the moon's orbital radius gets further and further away from the Earth at a rate of 3.4 centimeters a year. Exactly. The word is, uh-oh. That's right. The moon is getting further and further away by 3.4 centimeters a year. I mean, can you imagine the tape measure that does that kind of an announcement? Okay, not really. Ba-dum-boom. That's a statement with an implication, right? It's not just a fact. It's a, well, if the moon's getting 3.4 centimeters further and further away, then what does that mean? That someday the Earth is going to lose the moon. Now, there will still be tides. It'll be affected by the sun. But bets are all off about what it's going to do to our seismic activity on the Earth. But we're going to lose the moon someday. Now, it's several hundred thousand years in the future, so, you know, save the date. Set a reminder, you know. You don't want to miss that. You don't want to prepare for that. But it's going to happen. And therefore, that's a statement with an implication. And you better know the difference. What's all this about? We're in a series on the elements of our faith. Here in this new year, we thought we would take stock of what is it that believers have always believed everywhere and for all time when it comes to the Christian faith. And so we are allowing the Apostles' Creed to, in sequence, dictate to us a reexamination of everything that is elemental to our faith. And last week we began, and all we did was consider the first two words, I believe. What does it mean to believe? This week, we transition into what I or we believe. And the first thing that the creed says is that we believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. And on its face, that is a statement, a claim of belief that God is Father, He's Almighty, and He's maker of heaven and earth. But that is not a statement without implication. If you admit that, then it is more than just a, okay, that's interesting, right, check, file that away. What are the implications of believing that God is Father, Almighty, maker of heaven and earth? We're going to look at a text today from the prophet Isaiah, who's going to tell us that God is, in fact, Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. But the implication he draws from that is that in knowing that, there is comfort. A comfort that is real and not token. A comfort that is substantive and not sentimental. And the question we want to ask is, what kind of comfort? Why should we believe there is comfort in knowing that? We're going to listen to Isaiah, and we're going to consider just two ideas. What is the basis for that comfort? Why do we say that there's comfort in knowing that? And what are the implications of that comfort? What is the basis for that comfort? What are the implications of that comfort? We're in Isaiah. We're in Isaiah chapter 40. We'll start in the first two verses, and then we'll skip to later in the passage. So if you will, stand with me as we read Isaiah 40. I mean you too. Isaiah 40, starting in verse 1. Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem. Cry to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned, and she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. And then picking it back up in verse 18. To whom then will you liken God, or what likeness compare with him? An idol. A craftsman casts it. A goldsmith overlays it with gold, casts it for silver chains. He who is too impoverished for an offering chooses wood that will not rot. He seeks out a skillful craftsman to set up an idol that won't move. Do you not know? Do you not hear? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain, spreads them like a tent to dwell in, who brings princes to nothing, and makes the rulers of the earth as emptiness. Scarcely are they planted, scarcely sown, scarcely has their stem taken root in the earth, when he blows on them and they wither, and the tempest carries them off like stubble. To whom then will you compare me, that I should be like him, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high and see. Who created these? He who brings out their host by number, calling them by name, by the greatness of his might, and because he is strong in power, not one is missing. So why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God? Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the faint, and to him who has no might, he increases strength. Even youths shall faint and be weary, and young men shall fall exhausted. But they who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. Isaiah is not like a lecture on the moon. It is not a series of facts and figures that he compiles for us to simply ruminate upon. He is out to do many things. He's out to warn. He's out to decry. He's also out to bring comfort. As you may remember, Isaiah is speaking into Israel's condition right around the 8th century BC, when at that time, the greatest dynasty at work at that moment was the Assyrian Empire, which has its eyes on not just annexing Israel, but draining Israel of its brain trust. And so Isaiah is there chastising Israel for considering cozying up with Assyria. He's saying, if you do that, it will come back to bite you. Now, before we get to chapter 40, what Isaiah has done has mostly been to warn and to decry and to speak of judgment that is coming. Judgment that is not an example of God abandoning Israel, but simply saying, you have made your bed, I am going to let you sleep in it. But here in verse 40, or rather here in chapter 40, there's a shift. And that which was hinted at all the time before chapter 40 finally comes out into full openness. And that theme is the theme of comfort. And so he says in verse 1, as you heard, comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem. What chapter 40 is out to do is to give us at first reasons, bases for why we might think that in believing in God as the Father Almighty, why in that there is comfort. And he gives us three reasons, and we're going to unpack each one of those very briefly here in the first part of the sermon. Why is there comfort in believing in God as who he is? The first one is speaking of an authority that Israel contended with for all her days. And it is an authority that you and I contend with all our days. And it is ironically an authority that is both most subtle and yet most pervasive. And the way he begins it is what he says in verse 18, when he says, "To whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness compares with him?" And then he says, "An idol. Shall we compare God to an idol?" And you know what Isaiah does? He goes on perhaps the most snarkiest kind of language you could imagine. He takes you on what feels like a little Mr. Rogers neighborhood tour of an idol factory. "Come on, neighbor, let's go see how they make idols. Maybe Mr. McFeely will deliver to us our pair of tan chinos on the way." And on his way to the idol factory, what we see from Isaiah is saying unto us, "Oh, look, an idol factory. What do they do at idol factories? Well, first, you need a craftsman. And they need to shape it just perfectly. And it needs to look just like you think it's nice. And then the craftsman can only do so much. So then you've got to make it pretty. So you go to a goldsmith and you overlay it with gold to make it look pretty. But then you got to realize, you know what? Somebody might want to walk off with that idol. So you got to fashion some chains to set it up. And because that idol might be a little top heavy, you might be afraid it might fall over in the night. So you got to get chains and you got to anchor it to the floor." And Isaiah is saying to you and to Israel, "You think an idol is greater than God? Seriously? Seriously." Now, look, we probably should do a little background on idols. You read in the Old Testament about idols quite a bit. Idols were these graven images, these little statuettes that were either evocative of or representative of, or the believing that the very presence of an alternative deity was in them. They had them. They venerated them. They put them in their homes. They worshiped them in their temples. And those sorts of things are still prevalent and present in modern cultures. You can go to all sorts of cultures where there are little statuettes that people venerate and light candles to and all sorts of things. And those are idols. And Israel was bowing before them. And Isaiah is looking at Israel and saying, "Are you kidding me? You really think they have more authority than God, who is the source of all things?" And right now, you're looking at me going, "Why are we even talking about this?" Because you might be thinking, I have not been pricing idols on eBay or Amazon at all. I am not looking for nicely little things that I'm going to venerate on my shelf in my man cave. Not going to do that. Why are we talking about this? I'll tell you why we're talking about this. Yep, idols, graven images, statuettes, big deal, and prevalent in both ancient and modern cultures. But you know what? If you think idol making is in your past, you are wrong. Why will I say that? In Colossians 3:5 and in Ephesians 5:5, Paul rattles off a whole number of sins that you and I can all identify with because we go, "Yep, done that. Yep, struggle with that. Yeah." But usually in the midst of those lists of sins with which we are to contend, that those who partake of them habitually will not inherit the kingdom for, there is this thing called covetousness, which is sort of an old word. We find it in the Ten Commandments. But covetousness is what? It is wanting something so badly that you would hope that nobody else had it. It is wanting something so badly that you think your whole happiness is bound up with it. It is what we would call, in more euphemistic elitist terms, inordinate desire. That's what coveting is. You want it so badly that you think if you don't have it, you're never going to be happy. You know what Paul does in both of those instances in referring to covetousness? He says covetousness is idolatry. Oops. You don't have to set up a stone or a statue to be making idols. You just have to want something so badly that you think your life depends on it. And if you don't have it, life ain't worth living. That's an idol. You know what you can idolize? You can idolize having a mate. Mates are great things. I recommend it. Highly. I recommend a spouse. But you can want a spouse so badly that you will sacrifice your integrity and everything you might hold dearly just so that you can have a mate. Guess what? The mate's become an idol. Congratulations. You can turn into an idol the very notion of a claim. You can want it so badly that you will give up everything, sacrifice every good thing, trample on any good relationship just so that you might be applauded. You can like a claim so much that it becomes an idol. You can love power so much that you will try to deprive others of power in order to get some or to preserve power. Guess what? You've just made something like that that is in other instances and other manifestations particularly innocuous and could even be beneficial. But you've turned it into an idol because we make idols. And what Isaiah therefore says to the 8th century, he says unto you. Seriously? God, who is responsible for the existence of all things, is not as worthy of your devotion as something else that you might think so important that you think you can't be happy without it? Seriously? Why is God greater than anything that you might be inordinately devoted to? The reason Isaiah gives is because it will be revealed in time that whatever you idolize will fall under the weight of the pressure you apply to it for it making you happy. It won't deliver. It won't satisfy. In 1 Samuel 5, the Philistine Dagon is in the Philistine temple, and it's at that point that they have captured Israel's Ark of the Covenant. And they bring that booty into the temple and lay it next to their god as if to say, ha! And on two separate instances, it says in 1 Samuel 5, the Philistines get up the next morning, walk into the temple, and the Dagon is fallen over next to the ark. That, my friends, is a metaphor for whatever you would idolize. At some point, whatever you might so long for and even get for a season will show itself to be unstable. And if you hitch your wagon to that, your wagon will be unstable too. The first basis for believing that there is comfort in God, Isaiah says, is that God is greater than anything you might be inordinately devoted to. There's a second reason. And it's the second reason is the second greatest authority that Israel would give itself to, not so much to find comfort in the authority, but actually to placate that authority. We've just said that God is greater than anything you might be inordinately devoted to. Isaiah is second of all going to say that God is greater than anything you might be palpably fearful of. And so he says in verse 22, it is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them like a tent to dwell in, who brings princes to nothing and makes the rulers of the earth as emptiness. He's talking about powers. He's talking about dynasties. And as we've said at the top of this sermon, who is Israel contending with in the 8th century? The Assyrian Empire. And who will Judah contend with in the 7th century? The Babylonian Empire. And what is up in that moment? Israel is caught in the crossfire of the Assyrian Empire and the Egyptian Empire. And what does Israel do? It's trying to make its bet on which geopolitical power has the best chance of preserving Israel's existence. And so Israel cozies up with Assyria. And then later in Isaiah 39, just before here, you see King Hezekiah of Judah letting an envoy from Babylon walk into the temple and see everything that Israel and Judah is all about, believing that Babylon might be a safe bet. Well, in both cases, Assyria and Babylon are not a safe bet. And so Israel, or rather Isaiah in Isaiah, is trying to warn Israel, beware. You cozy up with a power that tells you everything you want to believe, it will bite you where it counts in the end. There's nothing new under the sun. And so he says, look, you're impressed, Israel, with certain powers and princes. You're even enamored with certain powers and princes. And I am here to tell you, would you look up? Would you look around and realize this? Those powers, those princes, they might be impressive, but they are nothing compared to the one who is responsible for the existence of all things, in whom is the origin of all power and authority. That's what he's saying. From a geopolitical standpoint, if you just think about human history, the China that is now under, what's his name? Wu? Right. Sorry. I'm not up on my geopolitics. The China that is now is not the China of the Han Dynasty. There may be customs and traditions that thread their way through its history, but if you think the same China that is as the same China that was, it's not. If you think the India that is now is the same as the Vedic dynasty of the 3rd century Iron Age, you're wrong. It's not. And remember that phrase, Roman Empire? Where's that? It's in my history book. That's where it is. Empires come, empires go. And you walk into any major metroplex in America, metropolitan area in America, and you think, this will always be here. And you have to think to yourself, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Now, that's great. From a geopolitical standpoint, you're right. Things change. And so to put your hope in any one of them would be, historically speaking, rather ridiculous. But let's boil it down into a personal situation. If you have a boss, then that boss has the power to hire or fire you. If that boss asks you to do something objectionable, contrary to your integrity, and you follow him, then it is because you have believed that his power is greater than the one from whom he gets all power. If you have a mother-in-law who has mastered the art of manipulation and coercion, and you allow that skill set to intrude upon your vows, then it is because you have believed that their power is greater than God's. If you are in the presence of a political power, an elected official, who has the power to enact policy that has broad-ranging implications for a lot of people, if you look aside at something that they do that is duplicitous and dangerous, and you allow them to do what you do, then it is because you believe that their power is greater than God's. And Isaiah is looking at each one of us and saying, are you kidding me? He is saying God's power is greater than anything that you might be palpably fearful of. And the implication of that is not that you are supposed to be more fearful of God than other things. The implication is that that boss, that in-law, that elected official, all they're going to do for you is provoke fear in you. And you might take a little bit of comfort in being able to placate their fear, placate their power over you. They provoke fear in you, but they will never strike in you love for them. And Isaiah is saying God's power is greater because God is out to provoke not just fear from you, but love for him, that he would be endeared to you. And in his endearment to you, there is comfort. Isaiah is saying God is greater than anything that you might be inordinately devoted to, and God is greater than anything you might be palpably fearful of. And there's a third thing that establishes why there is comfort to be found in God. And that has to do with what we find in verses 25 and 26. To whom then will you compare me that I should be like him, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high and see. Who created these? He who brings out their host by number, calling them all by name, by the greatness of his might, and because he is strong in power, not one is missing. What's he talking about? He's talking about what there is a picture of on the front of your bulletin. He's talking about the celestial bodies, the stars, the planets, the quasars, the black holes, the dark matter, all that great stuff, all this stuff whose power is immeasurable. There's an article in The Atlantic that came out last week that said, for about 20 years, we have believed that there are about 100 to 200 billion stars in the universe. And with the help of the Hubble telescope, who snapped this picture, nicely focused, it's been discovered that there are actually 2 trillion stars in the universe. So with the help of this little telescope, there are 10 times more stars than we would have ever imagined. It's that big. A lot of stuff goes bump in the night in this universe. A lot of stuff. And Isaiah is saying unto us, just look up and then ask yourself this: what best accounts for all of that? Now, the most popular non-theistic, atheistic argument for the example or the evidence of all things is just to say, you know what? This universe is the product of perhaps multiple universes that have existed over time, and so they have this theory of the multiverse, right? And we all think, well, that's fascinating, but doesn't that just sort of take the question a little bit step further? Well, if there are many universes, where did they come from? Is the evidence of the heavens a slam dunk argument for the existence of God? Nope. It's not. But if you will consider all of the scientific or non-theistic arguments to explain why there might not be an intelligence behind all things, you will find a certain hypocrisy in the kinds of arguments that they raise. And that's why I quoted to you somewhat of a snarky argument from, of all people, David Bentley Hart. It's that middle quote where he says this: "Naturalism's claim that by confining itself to purely material explanations for all things, it adheres to the only sure path of verifiable knowledge is nothing but a feat of sublimely circular thinking. Physics explains everything, which we know, because anything physics cannot explain does not exist, which we know, because whatever exists must be explicable via physics, which we know, because physics explains everything. There is something here of the mystical." Is the existence of God verifiable or provable by what we see in the celestial world? No, not if you mean by proof that we can reproduce such things in the lab and find some sort of actual fingerprint of God in that. But the arguments against such things fall on their face. And therefore, there is, in this moment, on the basis and evidence of what we see, a reasonable and plausible case for believing that, yes, there is something greater and more intelligent behind all that we see. And if that intelligence is capable of doing everything like that, then how can you not also believe that he is capable of meeting you in your smallest need? There is comfort in that. He's greater than anything we might be inordinately devoted to, greater than anything we might be palpably fearful of, and greater than anything we might be properly awed by. It's the basis for our comfort, which is great. It's nice, but it's still pretty much an argument. It begs a little concreteness. What are the implications then of that comfort? If those things are true, and comfort is to be derived from those true things, then what are the implications? As I said at the top, Isaiah is not writing for the sake of writing. It's not a systematic theology he has composed here. He's writing into a situation, and that situation is of a people on the brink of exile. And everything that goes with it, social, political, religious, marginalization, they're going to go through it, and it's going to be painful, and people are going to die. And dreams are going to die. And they're going to wonder, as they are, where is the Lord? Has he abandoned us? Have we, by our belief in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, fallen prey to the same thing that fell to the emperor who had no clothes? That's the question that they're raising. And they raise it there in verse 27. "Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God?" That's what they're thinking. But Isaiah and the Lord answer them in verse 28. "Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He doesn't fade or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable." He's saying, given what I've just told you about everything that he is greater than, then no given struggle is greater than God's capacity to comfort. That's the point he's making. That's the implication of that basis for comfort. Given who he is, given his greatness by comparison, then there is no given struggle that is greater than God's capacity to comfort. Israel is sinking. And Isaiah is saying, God has stretched out his arm and asked you to take hold, because he says, earlier in Isaiah 40, which we didn't have time to read in verse 9. Get you up on a high mountain, O Zion, herald of good news. Lift up your voice with strength, O Jerusalem, herald of good news. Lift it up. Fear not. What Isaiah is saying is that God has stretched out his arm. And he has stretched out his arm in more than a metaphorical way. Because when you heard Isaiah say in verse 2, speak tenderly to Jerusalem, for her warfare is ended. Her iniquity is pardoned. She has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. And when he says in verse 11, he will tend his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs in his arms. He will carry them in his bosom. He is speaking of how God will act to bring Israel out of exile. Restore them to the land. Gather them back as a people that they might give thanks unto him for ending their days of struggle. It's more than a metaphor to speak of God putting out his arm outstretched. But brothers and sisters, why that has relevance to yours and my condition is because that metaphor is not exhausted by what happened in the 7th century. That metaphor finds a new and ultimate kind of fulfillment in one who did bring an end to warfare, but of a different kind. A warfare that existed between our own heart and the heart of God. That metaphor was not existed in the Iron Age, but rather found its fulfillment in one who did bring a pardon of all our iniquity, and who did take us up like lambs in his bosom and tended us as a flock, like a shepherd. There is one who did that. And he did so not by bringing the sins of the people upon their head, but by bringing the sins of the people on his own head. And there is comfort in knowing that. And that is why we might believe that in any given struggle, there is reason to think that God is able to comfort us in it. Because yes, it does. This world will continue to frighten you. This world will continue to take things from you. This world will continue to make you angry at injustice. This world will still tempt you with despair. But if we see in Christ a reason to believe that there is comfort, then there is also reason to believe that he will bring comfort to you in the midst of those experiences. Maybe not to eradicate them, but to prevent them from swallowing you up. Because if what he has done is true, and he has ended our warfare, and he's ended the part, he has brought pardon to our iniquity, and he's gathered us up like a flock, then yes, you might lose immeasurably in this world. But what Jesus means to tell us is that what you most could lose can't get lost. Whatever disappointment you might face in this world, your greatest disappointment can't be taken from you. The implication of this comfort is that there is no given struggle that he can't have the capacity to comfort. And the second and final implication is this. Those who might be comforted by him are those who have learned to wait upon him. Next to Psalm 23, I dare say what you find at the end of Isaiah 40 is the most familiar text in all of the Old Testament. Even youth shall faint and be weary, and young men shall fall exhausted. But they who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall not run and not and they shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. There is a strength to be had from the Lord, and it is for those who wait. And therein lies the question: what in the world does it mean to wait? What is waiting upon the Lord? I'll leave you with two thoughts, and then we're done. The first thought stems from that word, wait. Brothers and sisters, you and I are those who most likely tie our sense of well-being and identity to our productivity. You and I are surrounded with so many opportunities to engage ourselves with which we might give our attention to, that there is something that is not in your life that needs to be in your life. And I will call that thing fallow space. in which there are times in which you are doing absolutely nothing but being still. Thomas Merton, in an essay on music, wrote this on the front of your bulletin. It's at the bottom. If we strive to be happy by filling the silence of life with sound, productive by turning all life's leisure into work, and real by turning all our being into doing, we will only succeed in producing a hell on earth. If we have no silence, God is not heard in our music. If we have no rest, God does not bless our work. If we twist our lives out of shape in order to fill every corner of them with action and experience, God will seem silently to withdraw from our hearts and leave us empty. And if he knew smartphones were coming, he'd probably put that in the paragraph too. There's all sorts of good things to consider. There's all sorts of wonderful things to give your attention to. But if you're always making yourself attentive to everything but nothing, he says you're producing a hell on earth. You will not wait upon the earth until you reclaim a little fallow space in your existence. And the second thought is this. We've talked about waiting. Now, what does it mean to wait upon the Lord? Barbara Bradley Haggerty, she's a religion reporter for NPR. In midlife, she became a Christian. She's written some books. I'd love for somebody to read The Fingerprints of God, What Brain Science Tells Us About Faith. I wish somebody would read that and write a review for the backstory. Consider yourself commissioned. More than one of you, even. The Fingerprints of God. Boom. In midlife, she became a Christian. And then several years into her pilgrimage, she realized this life, this spiritual life, is as dry as a bone. And she goes on a retreat and sits down with the Jesuit director and says, "You have 7 days to fix my relationship with Jesus." He said, "No problem." No. And she learns. She listens and she prays. And then after that, she got her own personal spiritual director and lamented this dryness that she was feeling. And her spiritual director, whose quote I had on the front of last week's bulletin, I'm sorry I didn't put in this week, the name is Elizabeth Fitch. Elizabeth Fitch looks at Barbara Bradley Haggerty and says, "You know what? You got to realize you're in a culture, right? And that culture values fixing things. And so you bring that enculturated idea into your spiritual life and you think that God has got to fix your dryness. What if your task is simply to let you leave your arms wide open for the Lord? What if that's your only responsibility? Not to fix things, not to get your spiritual dryness fixed, but just to leave your arms wide open for the Lord." Now, the spiritual director, I don't think, specified for Barbara Bradley Haggerty what leaving your arms wide open for the Lord was. And you know what? I could guess. I don't know. We might be able to intuit ourselves. But I had the privilege yesterday of speaking at the Redeemer Seminary graduation. And my wife sat next to a woman who took care of her mother for the last 15 years of her life while she suffered from Alzheimer's. And she spoke of that experience as the devastation that you would expect her to speak of. But you know what that woman said about taking care of her mother for the last 15 years? That when you open your arms open to the Lord, that there is a blessing that comes even in the midst of caring for one whom you love, whom you despise to see in the condition that you do, and yet you find a love for them and an intimacy with them that you never had. That's one very narrow niche example of what it means to open your arms before the Lord to believe that in fact he is Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and therefore can even enter into the thing that you would never want for yourself or anyone else. That, I think, is a rather bracing picture of what it means to wait upon the Lord. I can't tell you what it means for you to wait upon the Lord or what it means to leave your arms wide open, but I bet if you asked him and reclaimed a little fallow space in your existence, something might come to mind. He set the stars in their courses. Do you really think he can't help you? In that there is comfort. For that we wait on him to bring that comfort that's not of this world. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.